One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm David Knowles, and this is Ukraine, the latest. Today, we bring you the latest news from Ukraine, discuss the woes facing Gazprom, and we speak to Dr. Jade McGlynn about democracy's strengths and weaknesses facing Russia's war in Ukraine.
Bravery takes you through the most unimaginable hardships to finally reward you with victory.
If we give President Zelensky the tools, the Ukrainians will finish the job. Slava Ukraini!
Nobody's gonna break us. We're strong. We're Ukrainians.
Every weekday afternoon, we sit down with leading journalists from the Telegraph's London newsroom and our teams reporting on the ground to bring you the latest news and analysis on the war in Ukraine. It's Wednesday, the 8th of May, 2 years and 75 days since the full-scale invasion began. And today I'm joined by our Associate Editor Dominic Nichols, Deputy Economics Editor Tim Wallace, and our guest is academic and author Dr. Jade McGlynn. I started by asking Dom for the latest news from Ukraine.
Well, hi everybody. Thanks, David. Welcome back, Jade. Welcome, Tim. Big strikes on energy infrastructure overnight across Ukraine. Ukrainian forces shot down 39 of 55 missiles and 20 of 21 drones launched by Russian troops overnight. This comes from Air Force Commander Mikhailo Olishuk. Russia carried out large-scale attack mainly in the centre and the west of the country, targeting Poltava, Kirovohrad, Zaporizhia, Lviv, Ivano-Frankivsk, Kyiv and Vinnytsia oblasts, mainly going for energy infrastructure again, although more, as I'll be saying shortly. Three thermal power plants were damaged, according to Ukraine's largest private energy company, DTEC. Ukrainian anti-aircraft and electronic warfare units, plus fighter jets, were all involved in trying to bring down the munitions, according to the Air Force. And they say Ukraine intercepted 33 KH-101 and 505 cruise missiles, 4 caliber cruise missiles, 2 KH-59 and 69 guided missiles, and 20 Shahids. However, Mr. Olishuk said they were unable to bring down a Kinzhal hypersonic missile, 2 Iskander-M ballistic missiles, an Iskander-K cruise, and 12 KH-101 and 505 cruise missiles, and another Shahid drone. So they did the damage. Russia launched attacks from occupied Crimea and then Russian-held territories in Zaporizhia Oblast, as well as Russia's Tambov, Saratov and Kursk oblasts. They are to the north and northeast of Ukraine, bordering Ukraine to the north and northeast, as well as firing positions in the Black and the Caspian Seas. So Ukrainian residents reported hearing explosions in Kyiv from about 5:30 a.m. local time this morning. The Kyiv Oblast military administration also reported explosions throughout the rest of the oblast. The city is just one part of the oblast. Downed missiles and falling debris resulted in casualties throughout the area. In Kirovohrad Oblast, that's slap bang in the centre of the country, Russian forces targeted the Oleksandrivsky district, hitting energy infrastructure and residential housing there. That comes from Governor Andrei Rekovich. And then in response to this attack wave, Poland's Air Force said that it had scrambled aircraft to protect Polish airspace. They put a post out on Twitter saying, "Tonight, intensive long-range aviation activity of the Russian Federation is observed related to missile strikes carried out against objects located on Ukrainian territory." They did not have to engage any, or not that it's been reported so far anyway. Now, also yesterday on the ground, or more ground land-centric, Russian forces attack the village of Belizhevka. That's about 5 km west of the city of Kherson, on the right bank, on the sort of the west bank of the Dnipro. Local governor Alexander Prokudin is reporting this. A 65-year-old woman was killed in her house in that attack. Critical infrastructure in Kherson was damaged throughout the attack last night. The governor didn't say which facility was hit, but said that the city of Kherson was partially left without light due to the strikes. The attacks also damaged Ukrainian railways. The route of the, well, the Kyiv-Kherson route was temporarily damaged. The tracks required repair. The train going south had to stop in Mykolaiv. And then transportation was arranged for those. I mean, you're not going to let a missile strike stop you. We know Ukrainian railways do not stop. Transportation was arranged for those who needed to travel further on to Kherson. I mean, God, if it's not bad enough, they've got a rail replacement bus service. Thoughts go with you. Now, next, it looks like Ukraine has started arming naval drones with anti-aircraft missiles. In a video released by the Russian, interestingly, released by the Russian Defense Ministry, it showed a dogfight, basically, in the Black Sea between a Ukrainian maritime drone armed with at least one missile and a Russian helicopter, which I reckon is a Kamov Ka-27, the twin rotor naval version or naval aircraft. So what we see, and the video, you'll find it on our website at the moment. You can see that, have a look at it if you like. We see the drones zipping around on the sea, trying to dodge machine gun fire from the helicopter. There's video footage apparently shot by one of the two pilots and later released by Russian Telegram channels. Eventually the drone, well, it's either hit, but it slows and halts for some reason. The missile then either explodes or briefly takes off and then explodes. But anyway, there's a large explosion with water and debris going everywhere, briefly enveloping the helicopter. I mean, I wouldn't want that when I was flying these things, or not the Kamovs, but flying my little Gazelle. I wouldn't want water or debris anywhere near my engine intakes or blades. So they're blooming lucky they didn't bring themselves down. Now, Timofey Milovanov, who's president of the Kyiv School of Economics and analyst of the war, he said this was the first time a Ukrainian maritime drone had been spotted armed with an anti-aircraft missile. He said Ukrainians have adapted marine drones to carry air-to-air Soviet missiles. Many believe this to be impossible until today. We should now expect a rapid evolution of Ukrainian marine drones to carry other drones, ship missiles, and more air defense. Russia's main TV channels showed the footage in an apparent attempt, I guess, to show that its defense is encountering Ukrainian threats, the location and date uncertain. But I saw it and I thought, a bit like this this ongoing Trophies of the Russian Army exhibition in Moscow at the moment. When the public see this, are they going to be delighted that their helicopters are able to eventually shoot a maritime drone, or are they going to go, blimey, that's quite a bit of innovation coming back the other way? So I just wonder if it's a bit of a double-edged sword they're putting out by the Russian authorities. Anyway, H. Sutton, independent naval analyst, he runs the website Covert Shores, which is a very good website for this material. Do give it a look. He described the missile system fixed to the Ukrainian drone as another one of the Franken-Sams. He said, until now, the unmanned surface vehicles had been almost defenseless against aircraft, and Russia has air superiority over much of the Black Sea. But the addition of air defenses aboard some unmanned surface vehicles, may make them even harder for Russia to counter. The weapons attached to the Ukrainian drone, he identifies as two AA-11 Archer missiles. He described them as Soviet-era dogfighting missiles with a range of up to about 10 miles. But he notes the actual engagement ranges are probably limited by onboard sensors, so much shorter. At the same time, all the same, it is likely generally effective as a surface-to-air missile, he said. And a couple more for me, David. I note this morning Ukraine's parliament voted yesterday to approve a 90-day extension of martial law. You may remember President Zelensky first declared martial law when the full-scale invasion started, February the 24th. The measure has been repeatedly extended since then, and this latest one is going to take the martial law up to August the 11th. It was supported by 339 lawmakers, none voting against. So not especially controversial, but we note it for historical accuracy. And then just finally, A Russian soldier seems to have deserted from the army. He was arrested in Poland yesterday after illegally crossing the Belarusian border. 41-year-old man, not in uniform and unarmed, but carrying military documents, which showed that he had been fighting in Ukraine. This comes from the Polish media outlet RMF24. They say the soldier reportedly used what they call the migrant channel, which you may remember organised by Alexander Lukashenko, the Belarusian dictator. This is the route that they've set up basically to facilitate flows of migrants to the border or to the border region there, putting migratory pressure on Baltic countries and Poland for the last couple of years. I wonder if it's now sort of maybe coming back to bite them, if it's proving a proven route for deserters. But that's us up to date, David.
Well, thank you very much, Dom, for that. Tim Wallace. Tim, you've written a little bit about Gazprom. The title of your article is How Putin's Gas Empire Crumbled. You write, Putin's financial firepower does not include one previously reliable source of cash, natural gas. Tim Wallace, what has happened?
Good afternoon. Yes, that's right. Russia, just take a little step back, before the war, was obviously an enormous power in hydrocarbons and gas energy flowing into Europe. It was the EU's biggest foreign supplier of gas. And this was crucial for Vladimir Putin for two main reasons. One, it gave him an awful lot of money. Gazprom, which is the state majority-owned gas supplier, generated profits of almost $30 billion for the Russian state, or mostly going to the Russian state, in the year before the war. So it was an enormous source of financial firepower for the regime in Moscow. And it was also a pretty critical source of political power, because countries like Germany had done something of a deal with the devil, signing up to receive cheap, reliable Russian gas to fund their industry. And Vladimir Putin obviously then thought he had a chokehold on the European economy. He thought that he could invade Ukraine, take over in a few days, and the European powers would have to stand back because they were so reliant on gas from Gazprom, which came through enormous pipelines that were still being built right up until the moment of the invasion. And to his surprise, he was wrong. Those European countries decided they could do with a little bit less Russian gas. It was important to support Ukraine. So Putin turned down the taps. Prices shot up, but those European countries carried on regardless. And so the result last year was that Gazprom, instead of contributing $30 billion of profit to the Russian economy and the Russian state, made a $5.5 billion loss instead, which is clearly something of a shock to a regime that's used to wallowing in money from energy.
Tim, do you think the European customers will ever come back? Is this a permanent shift? And who are Gazprom's new customers? Who are they trying to sell their gas to now?
On the European side, a lot of money and a lot of effort has gone into finding other sources. Some of them already existed, places like Norway, which was already an exporter of gas into the EU, is still there. But they've also built new LNG terminals for those tankers of liquefied natural gas, which means that Europe can import a lot more from America, where there's that big shale boom creating a lot more gas there. Countries like Qatar, it also means Europe can plug into the market that's serviced by countries like Australia as well, that export a lot of LNG. So there are plenty of other sources, which means we're part of a bigger global market now. We have to buy those tankers to come to Europe rather than letting them sail off to Asia, but it does mean that Europe is no longer completely reliant on Russian gas. The pipelines are still there. A few countries like Hungary are still keen to import Russian gas through them, but most countries, places like Germany, have decided to do without as best they can. So they have successfully weaned themselves off that, what had become an addiction, a seeming addiction to Russian gas. When it comes to Russia, the problem for them is that gas pipelines are expensive to construct. It takes a long time. You have to get a lot of different countries on board, get the political agreement, get all the planning in place. They'd got that in place through a network of pipes into Europe, particularly the Nord Stream system that runs through the Baltic Sea into Germany before that was blown up. And it's very hard to replace. Russia's trying to build more LNG terminals to export its gas to other countries, to China, to India. But those are being hit by Western sanctions on the high-tech kit that you need to build those terminals. And Russia also wants to export gas through a new pipeline through Mongolia into China, but the Chinese don't seem especially keen at the moment. They're certainly not in as big a rush as the Russians are. So a lot of that gas is just piling up in Russia at the moment.
And can I ask, are there any sort of backdoors for Russia, for Putin to export this gas? If they can't send it through pipelines, are there other ways they can get it out of the country and make money from it?
Yes, there are. There's three. There's those LNG terminals. They are sending some tankers abroad. There's also a pipeline that runs through Turkey that takes gas to countries like Serbia, which are certainly rather closer to the Putin's regime than much of the rest of Europe. So the Balkan states do have access to Russian gas. And then there's also ways they can use the gas industrially. It's a big ingredient in fertilizer, for instance, which Europe does need. There was a big fertilizer shortage a year or two ago when gas prices shot up and it became uneconomical to make the ammonia that goes into fertilizer in Europe. Russia can use its cheap, abundant, overflowing gas at the moment to make ammonia, to make fertilizer, and export that into Europe because agricultural products are not currently covered by the assorted sanctions and restrictions on trade with Russia. So that's one way they can turn it into a product that they then sell into Europe.
Tim, you've given us a bit of the history and you brought us up to date. What do you think may happen next? What should our listeners be aware of about how this story could develop in the next few months or years?
There is still some Russian gas coming into Europe. It was mostly Putin turning down the tap rather than demand drying up from Europe. So there is potential for that to increase a little bit, particularly via countries like Serbia and Hungary. And there's also potential for a closer alliance between Moscow and Beijing as Russia tries to offload this cheap gas to China. China's certainly been keen to absorb some of the oil coming from Russia. So in the end, there's no reason why they wouldn't be keen to take some of that gas. It could help keep manufacturing costs down in China, help it undercut Europe and the US in manufacturing electric cars and all sorts of other gizmos that come our way. So Russian gas is down, but not out yet.
Brilliant. Tim Wallace, thank you so much for your time. Can I go to our guest then, Dr. Jade Miglin? Jade, it's wonderful to hear from you again. Would you just reintroduce yourself to our listeners and tell us a little bit about where you've been and what you've been working on the past few months?
Okay, thank you. And thank you in general to you, David, and Dom, and of course to Francis, though he isn't here for this podcast, and for keeping up the attention on Ukraine. What have I been up to? And who am I? I suppose they're both useful. Who am I? I'm a research fellow at King's College London. My research has always focused, since I went into academia, on Russia's war on Ukraine, so since 2014. And currently I'm splitting a lot of my time. Well, I split my time between Russia, between Ukraine and between the UK. And as you can probably guess, I'm slightly tired from all of travel because I spend most of my time in Kharkiv, where I returned from last week and to which I will return next week. And I've just seen on one of my local apps that a playground is part of like a sports complex near where I often go for evening walks has just been bombed. And it appears that some of the children who I always see playing there are probably dead. So please forgive me if I come across as slightly distracted. In terms of what I'm actually doing there, other than going for evening strolls, most of my focus at the moment, and this picks up a lot really on what Dom was talking about in his introductory remarks, most of what I'm focusing on is trying to help Ukraine's own, I suppose, self-reliance. So along with some friends who are soldiers and volunteers since 2014, we've set up a sort of consortium that gets money into Ukrainian domestic weapons manufacturers and also bluntly gets things to the occupied territories so that the resistance there can continue. And our main focus is particularly on, I suppose, those manufacturers who are regularly at the front. So we're talking they have factories, we're not talking about homemade drone thing, but on smaller enterprises or medium-sized enterprises that are able to go to the front and then adapt their equipment, their drones, electronic warfare. Some of them work on software. They often don't need to go to the front. They have other elements that they need to work on. and just trying to help that. Because since 2022, the Ukrainian kind of domestic military industrial complex, if you call it that, has grown 15 times. There's the aim this year is for it to grow 6 times. The Ukrainian budget, the Ukrainian government obviously puts a lot of money towards it, but as we all know, the Ukrainian government doesn't have a lot of money. And so unfortunately, it's only able to produce at the moment 1/3 of what it has the capacity for. So I guess this is just a small way of trying to assist in those efforts and to make Ukraine, not fully, nobody can ever replace the might of the US or of foreign states, but at least adding towards that self-reliance to try to soften the booms and busts cycles of Western military aid packages that we saw and that we're still seeing the consequences of now, particularly in Donetsk region.
Well, Jade, that's awful news to hear from Kharkiv. And please don't worry, take your time. Thinking about the people you know there then, and maybe thinking about the volunteers and the soldiers, what kind of conversations do you have with them at the moment when you visit? How have they changed over the years? It'd be interesting, I think, and important for our listeners to get a sense of how the war is understood in May 2024.
One thing I have to stress is that most of the people that I'm friends with are very patriotic. They were part of patriotic movements. They've often been involved since a very young age, since the Orange Revolution even. So I don't want to in any way suggest that what I'm going to say now is entirely representative, because I spend a lot of time in Kharkiv with people who are incredibly patriotic. So that's quite a specific space and quite a specific group of people. But I would say that even among these people, where morale will always be high, bluntly, just because if the Russians were to ever take Kharkiv, they are on the lists of people to be shot or tortured or executed. So that always helps, I suppose, to keep one's morale high. But even though they're so tired, and I think they feel increasingly abandoned, even with the aid passing, that was a nice bright spark. But I think everybody who spends any time near the front understands that at best, that's going to make things not as bad as they currently are. There's a feeling of, when will this end? I remember one of my friends telling me the other day that he shouted at his mum because she asked him, oh, when will this war end? Because she wants to come home to Kharkiv. And he said, I felt really bad, but it was just such a stupid question because I don't know. Nobody knows when this war will end. And I think maybe that moment of just shouting at a stupid question from your mum sums up a lot of the sense. There's constant, the deaths feel very constant, the attacks feel constant, but there's no real option of giving up, and nobody's planning on giving up, because the only thing worse than this war continuing is losing this war to Russia, not because of any abstract notion, but because of what that means. And we know what it means. There's enough research, enough information about what is happening on the occupied territories, that very logical and rational position to take.
A lot of what you're describing takes a huge amount of resilience to get through 2 years of something like this. I know you were having some thoughts. You wanted to talk a little bit about resilience of democracies and the sort of positive and negative lessons that the rest of us can take from it. What do you mean by that? What have you seen?
I think one of the aspects that I found very depressing last year was that essentially North Korea and Iran proved to be more reliable allies than European countries, and in particular, if we're talking about the ammunition, and more reliable allies, of course, to Russia than we were to Ukraine. And I started thinking about this paradox because, of course, yes, if democracies were to fully mobilize, I guess, like we saw perhaps in World War II in the UK, then they might be able to match them. But it's pretty clear, being realistic, that the European countries are not, and the US are not, going to fully mobilize in order to save Ukraine. And some of the other measures that might be needed would be too authoritarian. They're just not possible. I mean, UK or in France, you can't, particularly in France, you can't just commandeer thousands of men to go and work in a missile producing factory like you could somewhere like North Korea. And so I was just, I suppose, pondering this issue of how can democracies remain democratic, retain all of these rather pleasant features to live under, but match autocracies. And then I realized that obviously you're not going to be able, well, I didn't realize, I understood obviously that you couldn't
you're not going to be able to just copy autocratic mechanisms of governance. But one of the areas that I think is really underexplored is some of the strengths of democracy. So in particular, the way that so many people all around the world mobilized and got drones, got cars, got medical supplies to the front, informal security assistance. Sometimes they got other things as well. I mean, I think there were a lot of army veterans who whose wives at least found their guns or different elements that they perhaps shouldn't have but did still have in their lofts and finally got rid of them. And they're probably somewhere now close to the front. I mean, clearly those were the beginning days. Those were the early days when Ukraine needed everything it could get. Right now we're in a slightly different situation, and yet still that informal security assistance, it continues. But the problem is, as wonderful as it is that it's all decentralized and non-hierarchical, which is excellent, that also means that sometimes it's not really very coordinated. And it's the parts could, if to bring those parts together, not in any way to impose hierarchy on them, but just so that to have that sort of connection, that sort of horizontal network, I think could be a useful element, and is also, I think, evidence of how democracies do have, of course, their different strengths, but we give our citizens the freedom to organize. We give our citizens the independence to have their own agency and to do things, in some cases to do some very remarkable things that have saved so many people's lives. And I think that's one area. I'm working with Ukraine Freedom Company, which are currently also delivering a lot of informal security assistance to the front line, and also with some researchers and lieutenants from West Point. And we're developing this idea of unconventional statecraft. So the role of civilians in democratic states during the war against Ukraine, to help them and to try to see to what extent what's happened so far can provide a model maybe even for future conflicts. Because this focus on agency is important, but also I think perhaps especially now when in democratic countries we do have this real crisis of confidence in institutions and in large charitable organizations, which I have to say unfortunately is a crisis that I share, having seen the incredible work of small charitable organizations in Ukraine and the less incredible work of many large charitable organisations in Ukraine, to put it mildly.
Jade, we'll come back to you. I've got a lot of questions around this, but I know that Dom has just got some breaking news he needs to share. Dom Nichols, very quickly.
Yeah, thanks, David. And sorry, Jade, just butting in. In the last few seconds, it's been announced that the Home Secretary here in the UK, James Cleverly, he's been addressing Parliament. He's said that Britain is going to expel Russia's defence attaché, saying he's an undeclared military intelligence officer. James Cleverly says he's using the government's new security legislation. He's also removing diplomatic premises status for several Russian-owned properties, including the Russian embassy's trade and defence section in Highgate here in North London. He's going to limit the length of Russian diplomatic visas, saying this follows a pattern of malign activity in UK and Europe. He's literally just spoken in the House of Commons, and he's said, "We will expel the Russian defence attaché, who is an undeclared military intelligence officer. We will remove diplomatic premises status from several Russian-linked properties in the UK. We are imposing new restrictions on Russian diplomatic visas, including capping the length of time Russian diplomats can spend in the UK." So that's breaking as we're on air, David. I'll keep an eye on that, but I think that's probably it for now. I'll keep an eye and see if James Cleverly says anything else, but I thought I'd better bring that to you straight away. And sorry to put you on the spot, Jade, but I'd be really interested in your response to that.
Mm-hmm. My response in general is one of good, or in Russian it'd be davno pora. Like, this has been needed for a long time, or a long time coming. I'm very interested, obviously I'm only hearing it now too, but I'd be very interested to know what has provoked this. Is this a response to the so-called Wagner arson attacks that happened? Or is this, especially with the reference there to other European countries, perhaps it is in response to that? Or, I mean, I do find it bizarre that, well, it might have changed after today's announcement, but I do find it bizarre that up until at least today, the Russian embassy had more than double the number of staff than the Ukrainian embassy in the UK, because I don't feel like we're doing more diplomacy with Russia than Ukraine. And so you have to wonder what all of those diplomatic
staff from the Russian embassy are doing. And secondly, I do, of course, understand that it's useful to be able to watch them, see what they're doing, but and that there can be retaliation perhaps against our people in Moscow. But I would wonder, I mean, I would wonder how very easily our people in Moscow are able to move about anyway.
Well, thank you very much, Dom, for bringing us that update. And thank you, Jade, for your response. Just going back to your thinking about the resilience of democracies and the lessons and the tensions there, taking it in a slightly different way, I mean, do you think that, well, okay, I'll put it slightly differently. It seems to me that this is something that Ukraine is wrestling with, that you, on the one hand, there's an obvious fundamental desire to stay free, to stay democratic, but there's also a need to get people, for example, into the army. And I'm sure you've heard the stories that I've heard about some of the methods that happen to ensure that. And that tension between trying, on the one hand, trying to stay as democratic as possible, on the other hand, trying to find ways to match the autocracies and finding potentially that the only way you can do that is by being slightly less democratic. I mean, you can tell I'm struggling even with the question, but do you think there's something in that? Do you see that tension as well?
Yes, I do. I think that some of the stories that you're referring to with relation to mobilization, so the press ganging, like the taking men off the street, are completely unacceptable. They're horrific. And they're also pointless, because you speak to soldiers at the front, none of those soldiers want to fight with those guys who've just been kidnapped or like bullied into it, because bluntly, they're not the most motivated of fighters. So it's also not really that useful, even if we stay away from the moral and ethical side, which is pretty clear. I think, to me, this is one of the cautionary lessons, perhaps, to democratic countries in terms of resilience, is about preparing your population. One of the things that I will never for the life of me understand is why, after the full-scale invasion occurred, a decision wasn't taken to prepare women who wanted to and men of mobilizational age to say, right, one Saturday a week or one Sunday a week or whatever, the day isn't important, you go to this local territorial defense base and you just learn how to, I don't know, like clean a rifle or basic, or you go to the polygon, like the shooting range, and you learn how to shoot, you learn basic skills. Because one of the big issues that comes up a lot in terms of mobilization is not actually, I don't think, not from my conversations, not from the research I've seen, that Ukrainians don't want to fight or that they're not invested in this fight. It's that they have serious concerns that I think they have every right to have. These are concerns around training, the lack of training. Will they receive training? Will that training be adequate? And it has to be said that even a lot of the training that happens in NATO countries is very far from adequate, because we have never fought a war like Ukraine is currently fighting. And the second element is to do with SAVOK, so like the Soviet era style of commanders. And unfortunately, the Soviet legacy is not just Russia's. Sadly, you do still find it in some parts of the Ukrainian military. And this disregard for men's lives, I think most of us who've spent a lot of time in Ukraine or who are Ukrainian can all think of at least one or two stories of somebody who's dead, who shouldn't really be dead, or certainly shouldn't have died then. And they're dead because their lives were treated not with the respect that they should be treated with by their commanders, who are often of a certain age, bluntly, and of a certain mindset, and may or may not have received training in a certain country, but certainly will have received it under the Soviet Union. That's a really difficult problem to fix. What can you do, especially in wartime? You can't just fire a large number, or I'm not saying a majority, but let's say like a sizable number of your senior commanders. You can't just put them to retire or teach in the academy. But it, from my conversations, and again, maybe this could be a snapshot, perhaps it's not the same in other places on the front, but from my conversations, the understanding is that there is a real age issue here. So those who were trained under the Soviet Union, as opposed to those who received most of their training or have had most of their career not under the Soviet Union.
Jade, as I'm sure you'll be aware, for the past few months, obviously, the news has been bleak and getting bleaker. You've been travelling back and forth. We were, of course, there back in February and March. Two linked questions. One, academically speaking, I'm curious to know what you've learned from your time out there. What are you learning? What's new to you every time that you go back? What do you pick up? And also, where do you find where do you find the hope and the good things to continue doing what you're doing, even as the news gets darker and darker?
So in answer to your first question on the research side, I keep on, a lot of my research focuses on the occupied territories, and actually there's not much hope, but well, there is. Essentially, what I keep on learning is just the awfulness of the system that essentially to me resembles something very close to an apartheid system between like the Russians who have been brought in the occupied territories to the Ukrainian citizens, and especially towards those who still identify as Ukrainian, despite all of the many publicly identify. There are, of course, many more who will privately identify that way. And I think this then links into the hope point, which is to do with the fact that the resistance continues, because these are territories where you have summary executions, where you have newborns being taken from their mums, where you have your children being kidnapped. And yet even still, even according to Russia's own statistics, they've not been able to reach a 50% passportization rate in the four oblasts, except for Crimea, that they occupied. These are areas where in just, what, 4 or 5 weeks alone between the end of January and the end of February, you had at least 75, and these are open source deaths, at least 75 assassinations of Russian military officials. And all of that just brings me to think that, well, if those people aren't giving up, it feels a bit cheeky for me, who can come home to the UK whenever I like. It's a bit cheeky for me to give up. And also because this war, of course, not in the way that it has for Ukrainians, but this war has really defined my entire adult life. It's why I went into academia. And to me, it resembles, without wanting to be too philosophical, because it wouldn't be appropriate in the UK, but I mean, to me, this war is really about to be or to seem, in the Russian phrase. So is this about fighting to actually exist? And yeah, to make loads of mistakes. Ukraine makes loads of mistakes. Ukraine isn't perfect. There are lots of things that many Ukrainians would complain about. But it still has the right to exist, to try its own, to make its own mistakes, as opposed to Russia, where nothing is as it seems. Everything is a lie. Everything's propaganda. There's no such thing as truth. And I guess it's almost about, what reality do you want? And I want Ukraine's reality to succeed, and I want Russia's to lose.
Jade, hi, Dom here again. Sorry to ambush you a little bit earlier on. Question for me, please. Very interesting, you just mentioned there to be or to seem. That really chimes with the question I was going to ask you. Tomorrow, May the 9th, Moscow Victory Day parade. Obviously, last year was a bit of an embarrassing spectacle with no tanks apart from the old T-34 happily trundling through the square. Very few other armoured vehicles. Exactly, yes. Manufactured in Kharkiv. Now, they've had at least a year to prepare. So on the one hand, I'm expecting tomorrow's parade to be big, to have a lot of tanks that may only make it 100 yards over the square, but that doesn't matter. That's all they need for the TV cameras. But there should be a lot of T-80s and a lot of stuff. But I just wondered, how do you, whatever happens tomorrow, if there's lots of tanks or none at all, how do you think we should interpret it? Because there is does Putin need an overt display of muscular might, or could he style it out if there are no vehicles, if they haven't got themselves sorted out over the last year? I'm not asking for a prediction about tomorrow, unless you want to give one, but how do you think we should interpret what we may be seeing?
In a way, I think you can interpret, I think that it will be a more impressive display than last year, so that's not necessarily saying all that much. But, I mean, we saw a bit of it yesterday, really, with the inauguration, or so-called inauguration speech. This is a man who's confident. This is a man who thinks that he's winning, who thinks that his calculation that he can outlast the West is going according to plan. And I think that we should interpret any sort of sense of bombast or even of overconfidence on his part as an invitation to try to reduce that confidence in whatever way we can, and to unsettle and disbalance him and his regime, which is ultimately feels right now very stable. But the best way to do that, the best way to make it less stable, is not to focus on, oh, how do we get rid of Putin, but to focus on arming Ukraine, because he has now tied up his entire authority with this war. And so anybody who would like him to have less authority should really have a vested interest in making sure that Ukraine helps to divest him of that.
Jade, is there anything we haven't spoken about that you think is important to mention or to talk about for our listeners?
I guess the only one thing would just be, and again, this is because I'm biased towards Kharkiv, but just, I suppose, a plea to remember what is happening. And you do that, but to everybody to remember what's happening to Kharkiv, to remember this is a city of, what, about 1.2 million people, where they're still living normal lives, and also where most of them don't have anywhere else to go. A lot of people in Kharkiv have come from Donetsk. They've come from other parts of Kharkiv region. They're not intending to go anywhere. That's generally the sense of spirit that I get when I'm there. But it's hard. There's not electricity. There's not hot water. In a lot of cases, there's constant attacks. There's constant 500 kilogram glide bombs landing on residential properties. And I just really hope that we are not, the rest of us going to, in Europe, going to sit and watch as another European city gets, of this magnitude and of this cultural importance, gets destroyed.
Coming up, we hear Dom and Jade's final thoughts.
Witness history at Roland Garros, where old rivalries meet new talent on the clay battleground. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled access as the world's top players in tennis face off to see if the veterans maintain their dominance or if a fresh face rises to challenge them. Daily live coverage of the French Open begins Monday, May 20th. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Can I go to Dom Nichols first? Dom.
Yeah, thanks, David. So back on to this breaking news about the Home Secretary here in the UK, James Cleverly, has said he's going to expel Russia's defence attaché. What's the reasons for that? We don't know. He's not said. Good point from Peter, who's added to our comments. Thank you. Thank you, Peter. He says maybe this is connected to yesterday's, or what was it, Monday night's news of this massive data breach into British MOD, taking personnel details and bank details and what have you. It might be to do with that. It could be, there was last week, NATO members said they were deeply concerned about some recent attacks attributed to Russia across Europe, in Czechia, the Czech Republic, Estonia, Germany, Latvia, Lithuania and Poland. So we're not sure. However, some more comments from James Cleverly. He said he expected the response to this expulsion would prompt what he said accusations of Russophobia, conspiracy theories and hysteria from the Russian government. But he said the British government would, quote, not be taken for fools. He said our response will be resolute and firm. Our message to Russia is clear. Stop this illegal war. Withdraw your troops from Ukraine. Cease this malign activity. So that's obviously going to cause a stir today. David will be no doubt speaking about that tomorrow. But interesting what's happened in the last hour.
Thank you very much, Dom Nichols. Jade McGlynn, as our guest, would you like the very final words?
Final words are that we need to move out, I think, of this. I'm very pleased to see the response today from the Home Secretary, but that just more generally in reference to this war and to Russia's activities in the UK, we need to move out of this kind of Cold War crisis management mode that we still approach everything with and understand that we're in a very prolonged conflict. For us, luckily, it's a cold one. For Ukraine, it isn't. But our cold conflict is inextricably tied up with Ukraine's hot conflict.
Ukraine the Latest is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our Ukraine news, analysis and dispatches from the ground, subscribe to The Telegraph. you can get your first 3 months for just £1 at www.telegraph.co.uk/Ukraine the latest. Or sign up to Dispatches, our world affairs newsletter which brings stories from our award-winning foreign correspondents straight to your inbox. We also have a Ukraine live blog on our website, where you can follow updates as they come in throughout the day, including insights from regular contributors to this podcast. You can listen to this conversation live at 1 p.m. London time each weekday on Twitter Spaces. Follow The Telegraph on Twitter so you don't miss it. To our listeners on YouTube, please note that due to issues beyond our control, there is sometimes a delay between broadcast and upload. So if you want to hear Ukraine the Latest as soon as it is released, do refer to the podcast apps. If you appreciated this podcast, please consider following Ukraine the Latest on your preferred podcast app. And, if you have a moment, leave a review, as it helps others find the show. You can also get in touch directly to ask questions or give comments by emailing ukrainepod@telegraph.co.uk. We do read every message. And you can contact us directly on Twitter. You can find our Twitter handles in the description for this episode. As ever, we are especially interested to hear where you are listening from around the world. Ukraine the Latest was produced by Giles Gear, and the executive producers are David Knowles and Louisa Wells.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.